mobile phones, laptops, tablets, and everything in between. This is Sean and Sean, and you're listening to the Silicon Theory Podcast.
Greetings, fellow tech seekers, and happy Techtober to all of you. Sean from Silicon Theory here, and because it's Techtober, I wanted to ring up Sean P. and give you some of our thoughts on all of the wild and wacky stuff that's been going on so far this month. We have the Galaxy... I'm going to get this wrong. Plunkett will correct me. The Galaxy Z Fold 2 5G in the house, which Sean has been testing for the last couple of weeks now. We have the Apple iPhone 12 and iPhone 12 Pro announcements that just got dropped. I've got my Google Pixel 5 on order that'll be shipping to me at the end of this month. And we've also had some hands-on time with the Samsung Galaxy S20 Fan Edition in the Plunkett household. So I'm going to ring up Sean P. here and let's get started.
Hello.
What's up, my man?
Not much. Sunday night. I'm watching the Dodgers game a little bit. I'm not a huge baseball guy, but I have lots of friends that are diehard Dodgers fans, and I'm hoping they win so those people don't have to like jump off a building or something.
I was going to say, I think you once described to me baseball as the most boring sport imaginable. Would that be correct?
Dude, I mean, the regular season is 162 games of, like, 3 hours of boredom, so yes. I tend to like playoffs. I'll watch the playoffs, but, yeah, baseball's, you know, not the best sport ever.
Yeah, I have been a big baseball fan in the past, and I'm a huge Mariners fan, and so every year when they suck, I just stop watching about 15 games into the season, and then my life is much better thereby, so we're good there.
Yeah, no, it's funny too, like, I played all growing up and enjoyed it, but my son played a couple seasons and played soccer and basketball and a couple other sports, and baseball was the one he was like, nah, I'm good. Like, right at the time the kids started pitching, and they're just walking kids around the diamond, and it's like, you know, 2 hours of watching kids get walked all around, it was like, nah, I don't want to do this anymore. I can't really blame him.
Yeah, that checks out. I agree. Jack's smarter than probably both of us.
So where are we starting? I was thinking, it's been bonkers. We have all the iPhones. We yep. have Pixels. We have the AT. I mean, you name it.
Yep, we've got, I think I led the open with, you've been having sort of a test time with the, and I knew I was going to call it wrong, but is it the Samsung Galaxy Z Fold 2 5G? Is that the right name?
Yeah, that name is just an abomination. So, yeah, you know, a few years ago, you can listen back to me on the podcast when the Galaxy S8 Plus came out, saying that T-Mobile was, like, on crack because it was $930, and who in their right mind would spend $930 on a phone? And now I bought one that retails for, like, $2,000. Shout out to the guys on our Galaxy Fold, though. They know all the tricks, so I spent less than that. But, yeah, I've been using it for the last... I've had one for like the last month, actually, but I've only been using it really a ton the last week or so. It turned out they launched and there was absolutely no cases for the phone, except for Samsung that released just a case for the back half, which doesn't seem particularly useful to me. I was a little bit reticent to carry it around without a case. But now I have a couple cases and I've been messing around with it more. And it's a ton of fun. You know, look, candy bar phones are all pretty good at this point, but they're pretty stagnant. There's not really a lot to necessarily differentiate one from the other. And, you know, this is something completely different. The front screen is a lot larger this year, to the point it's like 6.2 inches. So it's narrow. It's a weird aspect ratio. And so, but it's usable. So, you know, I've been messing around with the phone and you can look at email and notifications and pull up stuff and use it on the front screen. But as you can imagine, kind of the bread and butter of the device is the main tablet screen. And it's really neat. I mean, you know, you unfold the thing and it's 7.6 inches and it's 120 hertz. It has a single kind of hole punch in it, but you don't notice that much. One interesting thing I'll say is the crease, which I really didn't know what I was going to think about that once I had one. A lot of users will tell you it disappears when you're using the device. And to some extent, that's largely true. Unless you're off angle or outdoors, it largely disappears. In the sun, it's just too bright, you can see it. But when I'm, you know, in the house with normal ambient lighting, if you're looking at the device straight on, the crease really does. You can't see it. And then, especially at night when you're in lower lighting environments, you really like literally cannot see that it's there. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I mean, I can't wait to kind of put it through its paces more as a phone, and just less as kind of around the house using it as a tablet, which has been my use case so far. But it's really a fun device. I was setting up today, you know, a Dolphin emulator, which emulates Wii and GameCube games, and, you know, booted up Resident Evil 4, which I haven't played in many years. And it's awesome. I mean, the screen's huge and the hardware's so powerful that it's like, you know, you can crank up the resolution and all kinds of stuff, and it's smooth. And it's really a neat device. It's hard to recommend. You can tell that this form factor is a little bit in its infancy. It feels super solid, but at the same time, like, you know, the interior screen comes with a screen protector from Samsung, and it's fine. It feels plasticky a little bit, but it has to be there because, you know, it has this ultra thin glass, but there's a bunch of layers of plastic on top of that polymer, and it needs the protection. So it feels sturdy, but also, like, it's still weird to, when I carry it around, I feel like it's fragile sometimes. I know there's a bunch of guys that have been using this now since the last one came out, and the Z Flips, and they've had good luck with their devices, and they actually haven't ended up to necessarily be any more fragile than a normal phone. But I guess it just feels so foreign, the form factor and the way that it works, that I inherently want to, like, be careful with it.
Yeah, I can see that. And if not for the early leaked rumors of the Google Pixel 5 and it kind of being, and we'll talk about this a little bit more later on in the show, but if not for it being basically like a phone pretty much exclusively designed for people like me, I would probably be an owner of the Z Flip 2 right now, or the Z Flip 5G, I guess is what they're calling it. And foldables are just a really, really interesting thing right now. Like, yes, are they kind of a niche product in its infancy? Probably. Are they wildly overpriced? Absolutely. But there is definite utility there, and I think that as more and more OEMs get the ability to kind of manufacture these folding displays, or at least acquire them for their own devices, I think we're going to go through kind of a second renaissance of you know, what smartphones look like and what people think that they're capable of doing with them. Because, like you said, you've got this really, what is it? Am I talking to you on it right now, by the way? Are you using it as your SIM in it right now?
No, I'm on the OnePlus 7 Pro still right now.
Got it. Okay, so the essential commentary here is that outside 6.2-inch display is something wacky. Like, isn't it like 21x9 or 22x9, something like that? Like, super tall, super skinny?
I think 21.9 is what I want. No, it's taller than 21.9. It's like 24.9 or something, I think. Yeah, okay. It's a weird aspect ratio.
I know that I think it's the same aspect ratio as one of the Sony Xperia phones, which is just, it's that super tall, skinny phone. It's like basically looking at a... It's like basically if your smartphone was a ruler, like a classic ruler, it's like that. It's super skinny, but like really, really tall. But I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head. Like, it's there for you. I mean, the 6.2-inch size is basically the equivalent of, the 4A5G, the Google Pixel 4A5G has a 6.2-inch display. So it's the size of a modern smartphone, but then you have the extra ability to kind of fold it open and have this tablet experience that you could really do whatever you wanted to. So, you know, again, play video games on it, sure. You know, use it as a giant iPad style thing for, you know, Google Maps or whatever. Like, yeah, can you imagine in a world without COVID where you had this before you took your trip to Italy and you're there and you're like, oh, I need to bring up Google Maps so that we can walk around, you know, downtown Rome or whatever. Like, rather than having a paper map or having a Thomas guide or, you know, some kind of, you know, purchased map at a tourist attraction, you could just literally pop that thing open and then you've got Google Maps there and you'd be able to wander around and use your tablet sized phone as a map. Like, that's just kind of, it's really interesting. It's a really fun kind of application for that technology. And I'm really excited to see where the market segment of this goes. While I'm not necessarily interested in having that gigantic tablet style experience, I think for me, the Z Flip is definitely much more of something that I think that, you know, a modern or more mainstream consumer might use, because you can say, oh yes, I've got this, you know, tiny phone folded up in my pocket. And if I want to pull it out and respond to text messages or, you know, read a quick email or what have you, can do that. And then when I'm ready to, you know, Netflix and chill in the evening, I can just flip it open. And then now I've got, you know, this, six. What was it? 6.5. What size was the display?
It's 7.6 on the inside.
Okay. No. Not the Fold 2, but the Z Flip.
Oh, the Z Flip. Yeah, it's 6.9.
Yes. I believe. Okay. Yes. So, but essentially, you've got this really large, you know, kind of also kind of really tall and skinny aspect ratio. But it's great for 2:1 viewing of YouTube videos or, you know, any other kind of content, even if you get it letterboxed. Like, and then when you're done with it, you just fold it in half and, you know, away it goes. It's just foldables really are the future. And I think it's cool and fun that you bought one instead of me. But if not for the Pixel, like I said, I could very easily have seen myself with a Z Flip 2 or a Z Flip 5G. And I'm sure I would have been very happy with it. And I think that as that kind of tech gets more commoditized, more and more people are going to see the value in it too. So that's a fun thing.
Yeah, man. I mean, yeah, my cousin asked me about it today. He's like, well, what's great about it? And I'm like, it's exactly like what you're saying. It's just really nice to be able to flip open a tablet when you want one. And even just doing things as normal as Twitter, web surfing, Reddit, whatever.
Big shout out to Reddit.
Screen,
yeah.
Plenty of real estate. Yeah, and there's just lots of stuff that you can do, and it's kind of interesting. I kind of told them the same thing, like, you shouldn't buy one now, but it is the future, and also I would say the Fold 2 does not feel prototype-y, is the other nice thing here. I mean, it is, I'll give Samsung a lot of credit here, it feels like a luxury good. It's, you know, the hinge is a little thick, but it's heavy, it's got a nice heft in the hand, all of the materials are super premium. It reminds me of very much like a, you know, it's a luxury good is what it feels like to me. It's like, you don't need this, but it definitely has some utility and it's cool and well put together. And to your point, I think it's just kind of the future of things. So it's neat to kind of be able to jump into that early, because I think that ultimately you're correct. Most phones will go these two directions. You'll have effectively tablets that fold into phones, or you'll have kind of the clamshell style that you're talking about. And I think that probably within, it depends on how much they, you know, cost and when Apple does it and those kinds of things, but I would imagine within 5 years, maybe less, certainly a hefty percentage of the phones that are sold will be this. And once they come down in price, especially, and you know, right now they lack waterproofing, and there's some other things that they don't do quite as well. They're more fragile. They're not there fundamentally all the way, but they're neat, and I think it's the future. And you know, again, it's a hard thing to recommend, but it's like I'm also super happy that I have one because it's so unique and just fun to use.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there'll be some folks that would agree with you and that they would rather have it. And, you know, we've talked about it a little bit, but I've seen a lot of YouTube reviewers have been tossing their, you know, Z Flip 5Gs around, like throwing them on the ground and, you know, chucking them against walls and all kinds of stuff to just prove that they're not any more or less fragile than a traditional candy bar style phone. And I think once people kind of get over the, I don't want to say the stigma, but, you know, more like sticker shock of, you know, paying $1,300, $1,400 for a clamshell style or, you know, upwards of $2,000 for a tablet foldable. You know, once those prices come down a little bit, I mean, and we'll talk about the iPhones, like, you know, iPhone 12 Pro Max is going to start at $1,100. And for $200 more, you can get a phone that folds. Like, that's a really interesting price point to be at when you're looking at, okay, you know, what do some of these foldables have as advantages, specifically the Samsung ones with respect to the displays and the high refresh rates and stuff like that, because Apple's still playing catch up there. And there's just a lot to kind of, and, you know, no pun intended, but there's a lot to unpack there, because there is definite utility, probably not at the price point for most people that it's at right now. But, you know, once we get, you know, once that comes down by, you know, 30-40%, I think we're going to start to see a much higher adoption rate. And then I think we'll really start to see the widespread use of that technology really take off as people get able to get into that that kind of segment a little bit easier. So any final thoughts on that?
And I think there's just something to be said for phones are boring. We've talked about this, they're a commodity, and it's like, there is something to just be said at this point for, like, different and fun. And sometimes different is stupid, so you have to be careful here. It's like, you know, you could be a Pontiac Aztec. Yeah, you're different, but that's just because you're hideous, right?
You could be the LG. I mean, you could be the LG Wing.
Well, I actually think the Wing's an interesting phone, but, like, I would say for these phones, you're right. There's certainly downsides, but there is, at least in this case, there are use cases that you can definitely lay out where it's like, The folding tablet is awesome because you have something that's basically the size of a phone that folds into a tablet that you can use whenever you want. The use case for the clamshell is, you know, it's half the footprint of a normal phone. It's thicker, though, but then it unfolds into a normal-sized phone, and that's nice. So it's like there are tangible benefits that you can lay out, whereas sometimes in the past when things are more gimmicky, for lack of a better word, you really have to, like, dig deep to find any kind of practical application. So it'll be interesting to see, but it's really cool, and I can't wait. You know, we're in COVID land, so it kind of sucks, but I got to get you over to the house now that I have it in a case, and you can come and kind of check it out. And it is satisfying. It's like, you know, you fold it in half into a V, and it's like, it's the weirdest damn thing. It's like, yep. you know, the screen's lit up, and it's high resolution, and it looks cool, and it's folded. It's bizarre.
Yeah, so, very much awesome. So. No, absolutely. definitely want to come by and check it out. And I think that you've got a real, I think you've kind of hit on the head the thing that really makes the most sense for these types of devices now. That first generation model, or the Gen 0 model that got recalled, was hot garbage. And then the Gen 1 model was better, but still was really that kind of prototype type of feeling. And now this Gen 2, or, you know, the Fold 2, has really, in very rapid amount of time, produced a quality product that you look at it and you go, would I pay $2,000 for that thing? Hell no. Would I say that it is worth $2,000 because of the tech that goes into it? Yeah, absolutely. I can totally see that, and why I can see why people would want to pay that much money for it. And I can see Samsung making even more rapid advancement as more and more people want to take advantage of this kind of, you know, interesting technology, you know, kind of novel technology, if you will, in the future. So, like I said, good on you for taking the plunge. And yeah, I'm really interested in taking a look at it, as well as maybe one of the other interesting phones that Samsung has launched this year. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Galaxy S20 FE?
Yeah, I mean, Samsung released the Galaxy S20 FE, I think, I don't know, about a month and a half ago. It came out a few weeks back. But basically, with COVID and the fact that the S20 started at $999, as you can imagine, sales have not been brisk. So they, and they claimed this phone was not in development. They developed it in kind of rapid order. But the Galaxy S20 Fan Edition is an entry-level Galaxy S20. So it's a square form factor. It's kind of interesting. It looks almost more like a Note in the design language, but it's flat screen, 6.5 inch, 1080p, 120 hertz, Snapdragon 865, 6 gig of RAM, 128 gigabytes of memory plus SD card slot. Has wireless charging. They swapped out the glass back for a glass stick back, so it comes in a range of colors, aluminum frame. And it $699 is the asking price, but everyone basically had it on sale for $599. And then on T-Mobile, they had a deal where you could trade in a whole bunch of old phones, and they'd give you $500 worth of bill credits. I snagged a hookup deal code for $200, so we bought one for my son for the low price of nothing. And so we've had one around the house. He got the navy blue, and it's awesome. It does everything pretty well. It's fast. The screen, I know it's quote-unquote only 1080p, but in order to run the Galaxy S20s at 120 hertz, you have to set the resolution to 1080p, so I'm not sure there's an effective difference there. The plastic back, glastic back, whatever you want to call it, it's not as nice as glass to the touch, but I put every phone that I own in a case, and so does my son, so it immediately goes into a plastic case anyway. I'm not sure that matters. And even then, it's matte, and it doesn't show fingerprints, and it's going to be something that you don't have to worry about dropping and shattering, and it still allows you to do wireless charging. My brother bought one too, same phone, so we have two of them in the family. 5G speeds, so, you know, popped in his T-Mobile R15 SIM card, and great signal everywhere, and fast connectivity, and it's a ton of phone for the money. I mean, on one hand, it's like the exact opposite of the Z Fold 2. Like, the Z Fold 2 feels like a luxury product. Its existence is kind of, you know, it's justifiable as you outline, but it's really not for most people, and it's more of a almost like a fashion item than it is something that you certainly have to have from a phone. Whereas the Galaxy S20 FE is kind of the opposite. It literally feels like Samsung stripped out the things that were less important in order to save money, kept the things that were really important, like the 120Hz screen and the cameras, which I didn't even touch. It basically has the same cameras as the S20 family, and the pictures are fantastic. My son's been taking pictures, and I've been messing around with the night mode, and it's, every bit of flagship camera. So the rumors today, the S21 design leaked, and it reminds me very much of the FE. It's a flat screen, and it's a galactic back. And if you had told me Samsung was going to do that a year ago, I probably would have been like, well, that's stupid. That doesn't sound nearly as nice as the S20, right? But having held the FE, I kind of go, well, the rumor is they're going to drop the price. And if the Galaxy S21 launches for, say, the same general neighborhood, $699, $799, as opposed to $999, and the trade-offs are, quote-unquote, a flat screen and a glassic back as opposed to glass, I don't think the trade-offs are much. In fact, in some ways, I prefer the flat screen and the glassic back. So it's an impressive device, and it's like if you're on a carrier, you can get any kind of deal. I think it's a really, really strong contender.
Yeah, this device from Samsung is probably the most consumer-friendly product maybe that they've launched in, I don't know, probably since maybe like the original Galaxy series, which were, more moderately priced, but, obviously the economy was a lot different back then too. But I think, and there are a lot of sites that will tell you, or will, if you read them, they will say that the Galaxy S20 Fan Edition may be the phone of the year. And it's because what Samsung is able to provide you at that price point is really, really remarkable. And if you can, and the only caveat I'm going to say is if you can but if you prefer a phone that has that size and form factor, I mean, it's a 6.5-inch display, so it's a pretty good size phone. It's roughly the size of my OnePlus 7T, which, is not a small phone. It's a good size phone. It's a GSM Arena says it's 20:9 aspect ratio. So it's fairly tall and narrow. If you're okay with that size, I don't think really anything comes close to providing you with the value for the money, as well as the robustness of the feature set. I mean, you've got basically every single freaking kind of charging you can get in a phone. It's got 25-watt fast charging, 15-watt fast wireless charging, 4.5-watt reverse wireless charging, and it'll also do USB power delivery 3.0. And that's in a phone that is basically made of, an aluminum frame with plastic. So you did leave out, I'm very disappointed, you left out the most important feature of this phone, which is the Bixby natural language commands and dictation. But, oh, wait a minute, nobody cares about Bixby, sorry.
I do think I left out one of the key features actually, though, which is the 4,500 milliamp hour battery. It's massive and it gets really good battery life. So, yeah, I mean, this phone is easily recommended to almost anyone if you're in the Android ecosystem.
And your price point is around $700, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and even then, like, when you look at it compared to even, like, when we'll talk about the iPhones in a minute, there's some things that compare pretty nicely to the iPhones. Like, the 120Hz screen is no joke. It would be hard to go back to a 60Hz screen in this budget phone, quote-unquote, has it. So I actually, I approve. I think we talked about this in our Pixel podcast, and if Samsung's doing kind of the same thing, which they're going, well, phones have stagnated out. People don't want to pay a grand, and we can build a kick-ass phone for, $599, $699 or whatever, and that's what we're going to do for our entry level every year for our flagship, it makes a ton of sense to me.
And you've got a lot of longevity with this phone. It is using the latest flagship from Qualcomm. 865, not the 865 Plus, but still, it's the latest Qualcomm chipset. It's a 7-nanometer chip. The phone was launched and available, it was announced September 23rd, made available on October 2nd. So it's been out now for, 3 weeks. And I have yet to see a site that has a bad thing to say about it. And I was really interested in your end user experience, because, you know, I would figure that the 120 hertz display and using the latest Snapdragon chip, you know, even with the 4,500 milliamp hour battery, would mean that the battery life might be average at best. But it sounds like from what you're saying that it's really good. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, the battery life for both my brother and my son is very, very strong. Their use cases are slightly different. My son is just playing, you know, 5 hours of Among Us. And my brother, though, is using it more for, you know, calls and texts and a variety of things. And both of them have remarked on how good the battery life is.
I'm going to have to tell you then, that makes Jack sus. You know what I'm saying? Jack playing Among Us all the time. It makes him sus. Is he the imposter?
Sometimes. And I love... Man, it's amazing how fast this stuff just creeps. It's like, that's sus, bro. That's sus, bro. Like 57 times. Like I'm gonna have to pull my ears off of my head because I can't handle it.
It became a meme in about 4 minutes. Seriously.
Yeah, I become that angry old man shaking my fist, going, "Get off my lawn! And stop saying sus." It's a really, really solid device, and it's a good direction for Samsung. Phones got really expensive, and I think that. Like looking at the S21, it seems like it's more of a in line with the FE than it is the S20. And I think for the average buyer, or even for companies trying to sell phones, it makes a lot of sense.
And there are a few companies trying to sell phones, and I think maybe that actually ends up being a really nice segue. I mean, we've talked about the Fan Edition as maybe, you know, arguably the phone of the year. And if you're in the $700 price bracket, there's probably not any other phone you should choose. If there was a phone that you might consider choosing, and you're on Android, you're probably looking very hard at one of the new Pixel phones that was announced. So specifically, I'm referring to the 4A 5G and the Pixel 5, which I mentioned at the top of the pod. I've already got my Pixel 5 on pre-order. I mentioned a little bit earlier that this is a phone that was almost, it feels like it was almost exclusively designed for me, because it has basically everything that I wanted in a Pixel phone, you know, minus a few compromises. But there are some very interesting and very salient points that we need to talk about, because I think that in a large part, most of the Pixel 5 reviews that I've seen have been incredibly favorable. They believe that it may be the best Pixel phone that Google has ever produced, but it also is $699. And part of the reason that it's $699 is because Verizon is the devil. But the reality of the situation is that the Pixel 5 and the Samsung Galaxy S20 Fan Edition are going to be very strongly compared to each other's. I'm not including the 8T at this point just because it is $50 more, and it does have some of the compromises that Google was not willing to make, meaning it doesn't have an official IP rating. It doesn't have wireless or reverse wireless charging. it doesn't have some of the other things that the Pixel does come with, but we'll talk about the AT in a minute. But it's basically a two-horse race, and the Pixel 5 and the S20 Fan Edition. And from what I've seen, and Android Police was probably the biggest critic of the Pixel 5, at least so far that I've read. Like, Ruddick was really not in favor of the Pixel 5. In fact, he was on Twitter today saying, "Yep, I'm done. I'm going to go on to the AT right now. I'm out on the Pixel 5." And I wanted to yell at him because I'm a Pixel fanboy, but I didn't, because I really want to get mine in house, and I want to play around with it, and I want to really see if the things that Google did to make the Pixel 5 cheaper may have seriously compromised it. But let's talk about it, right? So it's a 6-inch 2340 by 1080 panel. It's a 19.5:9 aspect ratio, Corning Gorilla Glass 6. It is running the Snapdragon 765G, so it is not the top-end Qualcomm chipset, but it is a 5G-enabled chipset. It comes in one SKU in two colors. It's 8 gigs of RAM, 128 gigs of storage. It's got a dual camera setup on the back that now includes the standard and the ultra-wide instead of the Pixel 4 and 4 XL last year, which had a standard and a telephoto. The video now does do 4K 60. It does 1080 at 30, 60, 120, and 240. The video modes apparently have been greatly improved, and Google introduced three new video stabilization modes this year just for fun. It's got a 4,080 milliamp hour battery, which is the biggest battery ever put in a Pixel phone. It's got 18 watt wired charging. It's got reverse wire. It's got reverse charging. It's got wireless charging and USB power delivery 2.0. It comes in two colors, just black and sort of sage. Sort of sage, or AKA Baby Yoda green, is the one that I've got on order. I'm really excited for this phone, not only because the reviews have been pretty much overwhelmingly positive, but the biggest criticism that I've seen so far is that people feel that Google priced it too high. Well, newsflash, Google's priced their phones too high every year. And I've seen a lot of people who are comparing it to other phones. And you know, this is, and we can talk about this, but rightly so. Like, comparing it to another phone that's at $699 is definitely a valid, you know, criticism. But I think if you're looking at it from the standpoint of compare it to other Pixel phones, I think it is probably the phone with the least amount of compromises, the most amount of user feedback taken into consideration from the Google standpoint, because people complained about the battery life. Let's shove a giant battery in there. People complained that the telephoto wasn't as useful as a wide angle. Let's put a wide angle in there. People complained about the rising price of phones. So we're going to pull out the Snapdragon 865. And we're going to put in the 765G in there instead and drop the price by a couple $100. To me, the Pixel 5 is going to be, or is likely to be, from everything that I've read, greater than the sum of its parts. You get a pretty good a pretty good hardware experience and a really good software experience. And that does things from usability, from camera processing, from just kind of a quality of life thing. And again, this is kind of the point that I made with the S20 Fan Edition. Like, it is a 6-inch display. It is a very, I'm going to laugh when I say small phone, but it is a small one-handed phone that has kind of been universally praised as being like really kind of the sweet spot for size for most people. And I think it is that. I think the Google Pixel 5 is a Pixel phone for most people. And if you're shopping at the $700 price point, you've basically got two options, like I said. And it doesn't have some of the bells and whistles and the hardware spec that the S20 FE does. But I think it has one single advantage, and that is it's got Google's software power behind it. And that, to me, is what makes a better user experience and why I bought that phone. So what are you thinking about the Pixel 5?
I think that most of what you're saying jives with my impressions of the phone. Overall, I really love it. I think they nailed a lot of things, certainly that in years past Google has not nailed. I think the design looks great. They managed to, I think, be the first on the market almost with a phone that has completely uniform bezels,
yep,
which sounds like a trivial thing, but it really does make it look kind of a cut above. It has the small hole punch in the corner. I like the fact that the phone's metal. I know it's coated, and it has kind of a cutout for the wireless charging, but glass phones became the norm because everyone needed wireless charging. It was like the only quote-unquote premium material that worked. But it really has a lot of downsides, namely, you know, cracks easily and shatters, right? So yep. I really like that they kind of found a solution here. I like the textured back. I like the colors are a little mellow this year. They don't have, like, the pop of the button or whatever. But I really like the subtle sage. I think it's a neat color. I like the it has, like, a gloss logo on the back and a gloss power button that looks neat in an understated way. I think that the decision to go from an 865 to a 765 largely doesn't matter that much to most people. The only caveat would be if you're a heavy gamer. I saw Ruddick say, you know, Fortnite doesn't run well on it. I'm sure that's probably true, but for most people, I'm not sure how many people are running Fortnite on their phone with regularity. There are people that are doing it, but I'm not sure. That certainly wouldn't be in my top 100 things I would be looking at for a phone. So
nah, not at all.
Overall, I think that they nailed the fundamentals. The giant battery is a big deal. I can't remember the last Pixel phone that had even like really above average battery life, and everyone is saying that the battery life on this is relatively outstanding. And I think that's a lot more important to most buyers than the quote-unquote GPU downgrade from the 865 to the 765. The only thing that I would take umbrage with, and I wish they hadn't done, although I know why they did it, you mentioned the Verizon's the devil.
Mm.
This is the biggest bummer part about the pricing. In other parts of the world, the pricing is equivalent to about $599.
Correct.
And the reason that is because Google did not release a millimeter wave version of this phone in other regions. In the United States, Verizon, really because of the spectrum that they own, had no choice but to go all in on millimeter wave for their 5G. It's a terrible, terrible decision. We've talked about this, I think, briefly before, but basically the long and short of it is millimeter wave is such high frequency that it can't, unless you have a direct line of sight to the tower, you're not getting it. And so you can use this in some cities, in densely packed cities, but that's about it. And so these companies have to make a decision. If they want to do a phone on Verizon this year in 5G, your choices are you either release two variants, one that doesn't have the millimeter wave and one that does. And that's what Samsung did with the Galaxy S20 FE. They released two variants. And that was the way they managed this. Or your other alternative is you do one SKU, which Samsung has been doing in its higher end phones that includes millimeter wave, but you're basically, you're asking every user that's not on Verizon to subsidize, you know, the millimeter wave antennas that are not trivial. It's like $50 to $100 per phone. So the only thing that I would say is I actually think that was a mistake. I wish that Google had released a version in the United States without millimeter wave for $599. I think at that point it's like, it's a slam dunk. That phone, you know, price per dollar or anything you want to say, there's not really a whole lot to say about it. So it's kind of a bummer. But even at $699, like, it's an excellent all-around phone. I think you can make arguments for the S20 FE from a value proposition point. I think you can make arguments for the Pixel 5. They're not really the same size. The Pixel's quite a bit smaller, actually, when you look at the dimensions, which is
very much so.
A lot of people. But yeah, overall, I think this is to me, it seems pretty clear this is the best Pixel phone Google's ever made. That's my ultimate position on this. From the you know, 1, 2, 3, there's always 4. There's always been some kind of weird, you know, the design feels a generation behind, or the battery life substandard, or they're just too damn expensive, or what have you, right? Every generation, there's something. And this is the first one where I shrug my shoulders and go, yeah, you can nitpick some of the things that you're talking about. You could have the argument that maybe from a value proposition point, there's other phones that may make more sense for some people. I think all of those are valid things that you can say. But when you look at the device overall, it's their best one, incredibly well-rounded. And I think anyone that was using one as their primary phone, if you're just hoping to get, you know, 2 years out of your phone or 3 years even, I think you could do it without any issue and you'd probably really enjoy your time with it.
Yeah, and you're right, because if you look at what the Pixel brand has represented for Google, you know, the Pixel 1 had, I was going to say gigantic, but that's probably being a little bit kind, but it had massive bezels on the top and bottom and did not look like a modern smartphone. The Pixel 2, the little one, had those same bezels and a better display, and the Pixel 2 XL had much smaller bezels, was a much more modern phone, had front-facing speakers, but the display was hit or miss and largely trash. The Pixel 3, which I have and still use, is a nice little phone. It's a 5.5-inch display. It's got front-facing speakers, but it doesn't really look like a modern smartphone. And this is an era where Samsung is trying to shrink bezels massively and give you more screen real estate. The Pixel 3 just didn't really accomplish that. And the Pixel 3 XL had, what did we call it? The bathtub, Grand Canyon notch? I can't remember. What did we call it? An abomination, something like that?
Yes.
It was terrible. The design just looked ugly, and it was mostly to accommodate the dual front-facing cameras, which I think was a really good idea and allowed some flexibility with selfie-taking shots. And this becomes, it's kind of a joke, but it's also a really practical use case. Like, I was sitting on the couch with my kids the other night, and I wanted to get them all in the shot, and I just kind of, whoop, there I go. Now I can get everybody in the camera shot. So it was fun, and it's a good use case, but in the small one, it had a much more palatable kind of design, even if it wasn't a modern design. And the Pixel 4, it was really just, well, the small one had a terrible battery. So if you're looking at this, the Pixel 5 roughly is the same size as the Pixel 4. And the Pixel 4 has a 2800 milliamp hour battery, and the Pixel 5 has an over 4000 milliamp hour battery. In addition to that, the difference in chipset should tell you everything you need to know about why the Pixel 4 didn't sell, because the battery life was atrocious. And the Pixel 5 will probably do really, really well, not only because it's cheaper, but because the battery life, which is something that people actually care about, is really, really good. And it had Soli and, you know, these hand gestures and face unlock. And, you know, that seems to be, quite honestly, one of the most polarizing features, because we haven't really discussed it. But some of the things that I left out about the Pixel 5 is it does have a 90 hertz refresh display, which is nice. It does have an IP68 water and dust ingress rating. So you can basically, you know, allegedly dunk it up to 3 feet of water for half an hour and be fine. And it also doesn't have a face unlock. It has a capacitive fingerprint scanner on the back, which, you know, the Pixel 3 does and the Pixel 3 XL did, and a few of the other phones still do. But most OEMs have gone to an under-display fingerprint scanner. But it works, and it's very practical and probably also help cut down the cost. But to tie it back, I mean, basically the Pixel line has always represented for Google some form of compromise. It's basically a vehicle for delivering their services and kind of flexing their muscle when it comes to computational photography, especially since the 2 XL, Pixel 2 and Pixel 2 XL devices, you know, computational photography is really the thing that Google's kind of hung its hat on. So the Pixels have been, and probably still are, you know, maybe, and we'll talk a little bit about the iPhone 12 in a minute, but, you know, maybe still are the best still photography cameras for just pull out your phone out your pocket, take a picture, and you know you're going to get a quality image. Like, that's one of the things you can reliably count on with a Pixel. And I think Google has kind of maybe finally come around to the fact that, like, the days of the Nexus program are over. Like, they were working with OEM partners to kind of punch out, like, oh, here's something fun and weird that we can do with our phones. And I don't think people, when they see the reimagined, you know, Nexus nay Pixel line, I don't think people want weird. I don't think people want, you know, bathtub notches or to wave their hand over their phone to skip tracks on their music player. Like, nobody gives a crap about any of those things. What they want is a phone that looks good, that they can use to stream videos or YouTube or Netflix, that has good battery life, and that takes good pictures. And to that end, it seems rather bizarre that it really took five generations of Pixel devices for Google to get all of that right. And then here we are bitching about the price. Like, it's mind-boggling to me. And again, I bought every version of the Pixel except for the Pixel 4. And I can honestly say that I have paid way more money for a Pixel device that had way more compromises that I would rather not have had. And I'm not even balking at spending $699 at the Pixel 5 because, you know, by all accounts, the display is really good. You know, if we were, you know, picking nits, like, oh, the, you know, dual stereo speakers is, it's got this, you know, it, the top speaker is, it's vibrating the glass to generate the sound. So it sounds really tinny when you're, you know, playing YouTube videos and you're not using, you know, headphones or whatever. Like, it sounds good for phone calls, but not much for everything else. Well, you know what? I don't really give a crap about any of that, because what I want in my phone, and what I think a lot of people do want in their phones, are the things that we've already talked about. You know, good battery life, it's fast, it takes good pictures, and, you know, now allegedly the video has been improved to the point where I'm not, you know, completely embarrassed to take my phone out of my pocket and shoot a 4K 60 video of my kids running around, you know, at the swimming pool or whatever. Like, I think Google, it took them five long years to finally get a phone that's actually worth buying, and it seems strange to say that, but
up to this point, I think the best Pixels were probably, like, you know, the Pixel 2 XL, I think, holds a place in people's hearts. And
I agree.
I think the Pixel 3, not the 3 XL. And then I think the 4 XL is actually a pretty good phone overall, I always felt. But to your point, like, yeah, I agree with you. This is, to me, like, it's the Goldilocks Pixel in a lot of ways, of the things that they focused on. So if you're building a phone that your goal is to have it cost less relative, right? And you said, what are the things that you would cut versus what are the things that are important? It's like, this is the first Pixel with a contemporary design.
Yes.
I mean, every single other Pixel has been a generation behind, and this one, I think, is actually stands up toe-to-toe with any and is like one of the, it's not the most exciting, but it's also like a very good-looking phone. They focused on battery, massive improvement in battery, which is, I think, most people's, if not their number one thing, certainly in their top three. They increased the base storage to 128 gig, which is a big deal because 64 isn't enough. And the camera is still, you know, right near the top. And the sensor is probably due for an upgrade. I think next year they need to. They've been using the IMX363 for, I think, since the 2 XL. But
yeah.
I was looking at comparison, and it's like, it still does really well. I mean, it's still, it's funny. I was looking at a shootout between, you know, iPhone, Samsung, Huawei, and Pixel. And it's like, the Pixel's no longer the best in every category. It's not. Some of the others have caught up in other categories. But when you look at overall, which was your point, it was still probably right near the top. And it's reliable. You're right. You can pull it out of your pocket and just take a picture without having to worry about it. So it's, you know, it still has wireless charging. I think 90 hertz is the sweet spot. I wouldn't want to go back to 60, but I will say, you know, as nice as 120 is on the FE and the Z Fold 2, the difference is not stark versus 90, whereas the difference between 60 and 90 is vast. And so I think there might be an argument, again, to be made here. That's why I'm kind of calling it the Goldilocks phone of, like, I think for most people, 90 hertz is probably the sweet spot because you get better battery life. And I think the panels are slightly less expensive if you're at 90. And it's like, yeah, the difference from 60 to 90, you notice. Phones should have high refresh now.
Yep.
90's kind of table stakes at least. But like, if you said, okay, it would have cost an extra 40, 50 bucks to have 120, I probably would have said, nah, not worth it. Whereas from 60 to 90, if you said, is it worth 50 bucks? I'm like, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So yes, it's not perfect, but literally we've been talking about phones for a decade, smartphones, and there is no such thing as the perfect phone. You and I have owned, God, I don't know, 10 each at least, and it's like all of them have pros and cons, and all of them are, at this point, mostly really good, and a lot of this is just splitting hairs, and it's like, and you can do that, and you can argue that the Pixel 5 is not worth it versus some of these others or what have you, but I think if you're doing that, you're missing the point, and again, when you're really looking at what you're getting out of your $699, for most people, I think you're getting an exceedingly well-rounded phone that will last you for years that you'll probably literally have almost no complaints over. And so I'm not sure what else you could ask. I think at the point that you're starting to just – your main argument is it's not worth as much money as X phone. Again, you can have that conversation. I think you can say that. Sure. But I think a lot of that is opinion. At that point, I mean, you could objectively break down the FE versus the Pixel 5 and go, the S20 FE is a better value. And you could do that. But, you know, look, Pixel software is still cleaner than Samsung software. You know, Samsung really goes for it by pumping up colors and stuff on their pictures, so they don't look nearly as true to life or have the dynamic range of Pixel pictures. And, you know, so it's like there are trade-offs. There's no... You know, both phones have pros and cons, so I don't know. To me, it's like I the reviews have largely been what I've expected, which is this is a really, really well-rounded phone, that we don't have a lot of negative things to say. Probably the biggest argument you can have is it worth the money? But again, like, look, you know, I don't want to sound like a snob or anything, but if you're going to keep a phone for a while, it's like, yeah, $100 difference isn't trivial, but it's also not... It's not going to destroy you. You know what I mean? If the Pixel 5 was $999, it's a very different conversation.
For sure.
But it's $699, it's like, eh, you know, okay, sure. An 865 might have been nice. I just, for most people, I was literally watching a guy who took a camera that, you know, can do frame-by-frame analysis of the two phones. He put an FE next to a Pixel 5. And yes, if you put it in super slow motion, guess what? The S865 opens apps
faster,
but to the extent that you would notice, not on your life, no chance. Like the difference is virtually imperceptible. And even when I was reading like Ruddick's review of like, well, sometimes it hangs or it does this or it does that. It's like, well, you know, as I said, I have the Z Fold 2 has an 865 Plus in it. And it, you know, there's still times where it's like I was scrolling through something on the browser today with the messages. Google Messages browser window, and like it was choppy and awful, and it could just be unoptimized software, it could be God knows what, but it was like, okay, no phone's immune to this either. I just think we're spoiled. Phones are so freaking good that we can have these conversations, whereas like, you know, legitimately 6 years ago, it's like, well, this one's battery won't make it through the day, and this one's camera is awful and has a gross purple haze on it, so what's more important to you, making it through the day or having a camera that's worth a damn? And now it's like, well, you know, if you break it down by milliseconds, it opens an application slightly slower. Or, well, you know, this one pumps up the colors in the camera. This one has better dynamic range. And it's like both of them can literally take pictures in the freaking dark. Like, yeah. It can be damn near pitch black, and these phones are so sophisticated that they can take a goddamn picture. And it's like, again, 4 years ago even, it was like, oh, it's kind of dark outside. It's twilight. Bummer for you. Your picture's going to be muddy crap. And so it's like... Yeah, I don't know. Is it a perfect phone? No. Name me a perfect phone. Yeah. It's all in the eye of the beholder. But at the end of the day, it's a contemporary design. I think the price is fine. I actually really like the Yoda green. Giant battery. You know, you get Pixel updates, stock Android. Lots to like. I don't have too many objections.
Agreed, and especially if you view it through the lens of, if not for the Red Devil forcing Google to price it $100 more, if this phone was $650, I think people were probably like, okay, the $50 premium between it and the FE, you know, might be worth it. You know, or, you know, you might still get some people who say, oh, spend $50 more. If it was at $599, I think there's not a ton of compelling arguments that you could make to say, well, you know, you should buy the 4A 5G for $100 cheaper, like just spend $100 more and get this phone. And when we talk about the iPhones, we'll talk about Verizon's kind of stranglehold right now on the smartphone industry, because you and I both watched a little bit of the iPhone event. Like, Verizon's dominating presence there was really disturbing, and the 5G hype train is something that really just is totally not living up to the hype. But I think ultimately at the end of the day, I think where we land is kind of the same thing. Like, this is probably the best Google phone ever produced, and people who buy it, no matter what price they pay, whether they're waiting for Black Friday to get it at a discount or they, you know, bought it on pre-order, I think are going to get a really, really good phone for that price. And I think it may go down probably along with that 2 XL and the Pixel 3 as, you know, not necessarily the nostalgia phone, but like, you know what? I'm really damn glad I bought this phone.
No, I think so too. I think people will look back who own it fondly of like, it was a really nice size. It was metal. I didn't have to worry about shattering the back. It had great performance. I liked the way it looked. It took good pictures. It was just easy to use. You know, it got updates. It's I agree with you. It's like all of these things are, I think it's going to be fine. And I also think it's super hilarious that I think if it was $599, it would be like the Pixel 4a reviews. I mean, I can't tell you how many Pixel 4a reviews I read. Well, it doesn't do this perfectly, but it's $349. Yeah. Well, it doesn't do this also, but it's $349. I feel like if it was $599, I would have read a lot of reviews of like, well, it's not as quick as this, but it's only $599. At $699, for some reason, that seems to have been a real trigger. And I can see why. Like, there's definitely a psychological barrier there between $599 and $699. But in the grand scheme of things, for a device that you use that often for as many years as you'll get out of it, I would say $100 is not the end of the world. And sure, I would like every device to be less expensive. But yeah, I really like it, and I'm really eagerly looking forward to getting yours. And I think it's a really interesting bookend to, you know, I'm buying this insanely expensive kind of almost prototype device. And I feel like you're buying more of like the end. I feel like the Pixel 5 in a lot of ways is like the end result of candy bar phone development. Of like, it's come so far. It was like they built this kind of like, it's a nice size, it has all the basics covered, it does everything really well, it's less expensive, the design's nice, but it's not anything that's too crazy. It feels like the, like, this is gonna sound negative, but it feels like the, like, you know, Honda Accord of phones. It's like, yeah, it's the one that you buy if you just want something that's super well-rounded, comfortable, will get you from here to there. Yeah, it may not be flashy, but you're also not paying, you know, a gazillion dollars in maintenance. Yep. And there goes my metaphor. But, you know, yeah.
Good times. I like it. And I'm going to definitely, since you brought it up, I miss cameras with a purple haze on them. That was Motorola, right?
No, it was HTC.
Was it the HTC?
It was the freaking HTC. Yeah, it was the, well, Motorola had their own issues with camera. Namely, yeah. They just didn't do good ones for 9 years.
They were bad.
But HTC, yeah, like the M7, it was like, hey, cool, you like that camera? You know what happens over time? Your pictures eventually turn purple. And it's like, that was just kind of the way it was. And we've come a long way, and we're spoiled.
True.
When we're talking about the things that we're talking about, if the Pixel 5 had come out 2 years ago, if 2 years ago the Pixel 5 had come out and that was Google's offering, people would have been like, holy shit, Google's like right up at the front.
Yep.
You know what I mean? But
agreed.
It's like now 2 years later, it's like, well, it's not perfect. And it's like, fuck off.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
My official position.
There you go. I stand with you on that. But I only brought that up because I have to use the joke where you go, the photos have a purple haze. Purple haze.
Please, just, can we? I already was cursing, so why don't you just edit out the first word and all of that? Just
no
go
way,
ahead
man.
And just,
no way. One bad pun per show, guaranteed, or your money back. So
we want to talk about the expensive Apple phones.
Oh my God. I was so literally, I watched probably 15 or 20 minutes of the iPhone 12 and 12 Pro announcements. And I felt so gross and so disgusting after watching the Verizon CEO come up on stage and say, now 5G is real. And I wanted to just shout at my monitor and go, millimeter wave sucks. You're everything that's wrong with the industry. And why is Tim Cook allowing you time in this pre-recorded, you know, Apple event announcement? But I don't know what to say. I think that, and we'll talk about this probably a little bit, but so basically, kind of in a nutshell, Apple announced four phones. So the iPhone 12, iPhone 12 mini, the iPhone 12 Pro, and the appropriately named iPhone 12 Pro Max. So there were some big changes, namely the iPhone 12 now has an OLED display instead of the LCD. It's not that crappy 828p panel that they've been using in the XR and the base 11 for the last couple of years. And using in the 8 and the 7 before that. But it's actually now a true, high-quality OLED panel, because Apple's been really known for their, you know, for the quality of their calibration on these phones. And, you know, the iPhone 12 has two cameras and the Pro has three cameras and it shoots a weird, you know, format and it has LiDAR and some of these other BS things. But to me, the big takeaway from the iPhone 12, well, the iPhone announcement, was that the HomePod Mini is back, baby.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is the takeaway. And anyone who watched it and took away anything different is wrong.
I watched an announcement about iPhones and I came away with a HomePod.
Let's just leave it there.
Exactly. The thing that really struck me the most about the phone announcement was, and I'm going to ask you this question. This is what I immediately thought about it. And I can't remember if we talked about it or not, but why in the world would anybody pay more for the iPhone 12 Pro when you could just buy the iPhone 12 and have 90% of the features for a couple hundred bucks less?
Actually, that was probably my biggest surprise takeaway too. I for some reason did not necessarily expect that. I knew they were all going to be OLED, but I didn't expect them to necessarily like all be the same resolution or all be the same refresh rate. The initial rumors were the Pros were going to be 120, and it's like, well, again, if that was the difference, that's a non-trivial difference. But they had problems balancing out the battery life, so all of them are 60. And I guess here's my takeaways with these phones in no particular order. The Mini is a really interesting device because it's really one of the smallest flagship phones in years, generations of phones now. And so for anyone that has been clamoring for a smaller phone with flagship specs,
It's
great. I just don't know how many people are out there that really want a phone that size anymore. It'll be interesting to see how it sells.
So for point of reference, for people who didn't get the announcement, the iPhone Mini or iPhone 12 Mini is a 5.4-inch display, 2340 by 1080, and the standard iPhone 12 is the 6.1-inch 2532 by 1170 OLED display. Now, in the past years, this is the same size, was 6.1-inch, but it was the LCD panel. So the switch from LCD to OLED not only has increased the resolution, but it's also enabled them to do some things that they didn't have the ability to do before, which you get the 2 million to 1 contrast ratio, you get a much higher max brightness, 1200 nits max on HDR mode. Like, that's just bonkers. You get the HDR true tone display, you get the P3 wide color gamut. Like, basically all of the benefits of OLED in two different sizes, now the non-pro edition. So it really, I kind of agree with you. I don't know a ton of people who are clamoring for, a small iPhone. But, the iPhone SE? This is kind of basically the old version of it.
This is smaller than the current 4.7-inch SE.
But with a bigger display.
Yes, and only slightly larger than the OG 4-inch SE. So, I mean, it's a small phone. Like, you look at it and you're like, shit, this is the smallest phone I've seen in a while. But it's expensive, right? Like, correct me if I'm wrong, does it start at $799 or $699?
I think it's $699, but let me pull it up. I'm on Apple's page right now, so.
Yeah, and it's only, the other thing that bothers me is both the argument, going back to your original thing, I would say that the 12 is the sweet spot phone. It still angers me that Apple is doing only 64 gigabytes as a base in this without an SD card slot. That's just
in the standard 12s. That's correct. Yeah. So the 12 mini, the 12 mini starts at $699 before trade-in, and the iPhone 12 starts at $799 before trade-in.
And then the I think if you go up, the next bump in memory is it $50 or $100?
Let's choose iPhone 12 mini.
I want to say it's 50 on the smaller ones.
We'll say SIM free, and 128 gigs is $779.
Yeah, so $729 is actually the $699 is with carrier subsidization.
Yeah.
Subsidy. I think it's $729. So
correct.
It's only $50
more. $729 to $779. You got it.
Yeah, I think that they shouldn't have the 64 gig anymore. But otherwise, I think the iPhone 12 is like, if you were someone that was in that more, I don't need a Pro. You're right. Like the 12 is basically, for all intents and purposes, a Pro now and everything, but it's missing a third camera, which, you know, we'll get to the pros in a minute. But even that is a little bit misleading because they didn't really change the cameras that much in the normal Pro. They only really changed them a lot in the Pro Max. And so, yeah, I mean, if I were a buyer, I would fall into one of two categories if I was in Apple land. I'd either at this point look at an iPhone 12 and be like, yeah, I'm going to buy that because it's for all intents and purposes a Pro, or I would buy the Pro Max because it is the one that has actual camera upgrades and also, you know, the giant battery and there's some other nice things. But, Apple's announcement left me pretty cold. One of the things I liked the best was the MagSafe stuff.
Yeah.
They basically have these line of cases and these chargers that are MagSafe that I think one of the pain points with wireless charging is obviously that, you know, if you don't get it lined up correctly, it doesn't charge. So this is an interesting way of solving it and kind of one of those things where I'm like, how did no one think of this before? But the actual devices themselves are pretty like, okay, so the A14 is nice. It's the first 5-nanometer chip. But it was weird. I was looking at benchmarks today, and like in the Air, the benchmarks are a lot higher than in the phones. So it's are they slowing the phones down? We're not sure yet. I actually saw a benchmark tonight that had the GPU performance in the phone for the A14 below an A13 GPU performance.
That's weird.
So maybe these are just weird benchmarks. But it's like, you know, there's improvement there, but I don't know if. We're in the splitting hairs era where it's like, okay, yeah, it's faster. It's 5-nanometer. It has a billion more transistors. Will anyone notice at the end of the day? And then it all of them are only 60 hertz, which again, like I guess in the Apple side of things, that's fine because they've always been 60 hertz. But it's like having used high refresh phones and telling you just, you know, a half hour ago or whatever that my son just got a free Galaxy S20 FE that has 120 hertz. It's kind of a weird. That's a weird omission of like, oh yeah, we're gonna just go with 60 hertz, and then the price has crept up, and the price has crept up because they support Verizon millimeter wave, all of them, even the mini. And the ones here, Apple did something really bizarre though. As we were talking about with the Galaxy S20 FE and even the Pixels, overseas, the ones that don't have millimeter wave cost less. Apple did the opposite. The millimeter wave ones in the United States are less expensive than they're charging for it without millimeter wave overseas, which I don't know how they came up with that pricing strategy, but it's ballsy.
They're Apple.
But I don't know. One of my buddies at work, who shall remain nameless, he's a big Apple guy. He watched the announcement and he just went, well, I don't see any compelling reason to upgrade. And he's a yearly upgrader, kind of like we are. You know, with the Note line, there was a year like that with the Note 9 where I was like, I see no compelling reason to upgrade, so I'm not going to do it. Which, when companies are losing guys like us who have to be on the bleeding edge and are willing to pay for it, I think that says something that probably the upgrade was just pretty menial. And that's what I feel about these phones. Although I will say the Pro Max camera upgrades, I am interested to see how that performs. They changed optics and I think up to a larger sensor and they did some other things and I have a feeling that camera is actually going to be pretty badass, but it's kind of a bummer because previously the Maxes both had the same cameras and so you could buy the smaller or the larger and, you know, have the same quality and now that's not the case. It's if you want the best camera, pretty decisively, I would say based off of what I'm reading, you have to go with the large one and that'll probably bump some people out. But like, I don't know. These phones are boring to me. I like the design. They have the flat screen and the flat edge. It's reminiscent of the iPhone 4, which is like one of the better looking phones of all time. Actually, it's kind of iconic.
Yeah, agreed.
But it's like there really wasn't a whole lot there for me. I mean, say what you will about the, you know, look, Samsung, say what you will. They've had, you know, a phone that exploded and some other problems over the years, right?
But that's fair.
In a world of like boring devices, the Z Flip 5G and the Z Fold 2 5G, they stand out. It's like, okay, those are something completely different. You're not going to mistake those for anything else or compared to anything else. It's like, oh, wow, that's really out there, right? Something novel. The iPhones are, you know, they've never been those guys. They're iterative and they do whatever. But because candy bars are so mature, I think the year-to-year improvements are even less. And I really think 120 hertz missing that was a missed opportunity. Because with that addition, I think I would be singing a very different tune where I'm like, well, okay, so now you get the new design, 120 hertz, and you get 5G. That's pretty great. If you're going to have a phone for a couple of years, it's like all the bases are covered. But now if you're buying the 60 hertz one, knowing for sure that 120 hertz is coming next year, it's like I wouldn't do it. They didn't make that many improvements, and I would just buy the one next year because that's the one where I would go, cool, I have everything I need to last me for a few years, whereas this one, the non-high refresh is like a pretty glaring omission for me.
Yeah, and I think you're right because there's a couple of things that that I came away from this with some kind of misgivings about. And the Verizon thing, you know, I mostly joke about it, but it was very icky to see Verizon on stage and get almost more get more time than the iPhone 12 did. The things that really strike me are there are some omissions. So we praised Google back in the day for the Pixel and the Pixel XL and the 2 and the 2 XL, right? Like you could basically get a small or a big phone and there wasn't really a ton of differentiation there except for the size of the display and the size of the battery. And that's kind of what the pros were, especially in the 11 series where the 11 Pro and the 11 Pro Max were phones that were effectively the same except for the size. And now Apple's gone and done something where it's kind of like, if you want the best of the best, but you want a small phone, you're kind of SOL. And that seems weird. And I wonder if it has anything to do with their strategy of splitting the phone lines from 3 into 4, where before you had kind of this weird, like the Pro was smaller than the cheap iPhone and the cheap iPhone had an LCD, but it was bigger and it got better battery life. And then you wanted the Pro Max because you wanted just the big phone, but you got the big phone and you got the big battery and you got the cameras and all this other junk. So it seems a little bit strange that Apple would be restricting some of their premium features to the biggest phone because some of their biggest fans don't want the Max. Like they want just a smaller Pro phone and now they can get it, but they're missing out on some other features. And you know, if not for that, like what am I paying my $999 for? I mean, I do like the fact that they eliminated the 64 gig tier from the pros. Like now 128 is the bottom level, which is how it should be. But like, why are they doing that?
Well, I mean, devil's advocate, and I'll give them a little bit of credit here. Like at some point you run up against the ugly realities of physics, right? It's like, you know, you have to fit all of these things in the packaging and if you want things like larger lenses or telephoto or those things, they take up physically more space. And I think sometimes you just get to a point where it's like, okay, you can't do it anymore. You can't meet those packaging restrictions. And so I think that's part of the equation. I'll give them a little bit of the doubt there of like, you know, it's amazing the technology that's in these phones, obviously. And also it's, you know, we're getting to the point now where, yes, in order to do better cameras in a, you know, we've largely hit the limits, I think, with the sensors of like, okay, unless you start putting in bigger sensors, we had this kind of like movement you alluded to earlier where it was like, okay, we had traditional sensors, but we got computational photography. And that moved forward the cameras and smartphones for a few years now. But now we're running up against that limit again of like, okay, so the computational photography basically allowed us to eke out every last ounce of what we could out of these kind of more traditional camera sensors. And so now you're seeing the Samsungs and the Apples of the world are like, okay, well, I need to get a bigger sensor in there, or I need to do actual things that are hardware related in order to really up the ante. But in order to do that, it takes up a lot of space. And so I think, you know, I don't blame Apple for this. This is just kind of the realities of, I think, the hardware and how photography works. But it is kind of a glaring, like, that is a bummer. It's, if you want the best, you got to go with the biggest phone. Whereas they were one of the few OEMs that were kind of giving people the option of retaining a smaller form factor and getting the best. But, you know, Samsung, they're in the same boat, right? The Ultra Note and S20 respectively, their cameras have a giant hump, and physically they couldn't get that into the smaller sized phones, or the Z Fold 2 for that matter. And so, you know, they don't have that sensor. They don't have the 180 megapixel sensor because they physically couldn't fit it. And then we saw renders of the S21 Ultra leak out today, and it's like, it has a giant ass camera hump.
It does.
And so we're kind of in this weird era now where it's like, okay, well, you know, we've hit the limits of normal sensors, traditional sensors. We've hit the limits, not completely, but of computational photography to augment that. And now the next frontier is these giant sensors, or, you know, advances in optics, but that there's a price to pay for that, which is they take up a lot more room. And so
let me see
if this maintains over the years.
Yeah, let me hit you with something, because this also was something that I took away from the announcement. So the 12 and the 12 Pro are now exactly the same size, 6.1 inch display. Couldn't they have taken the Pro and made it a little bit bigger, maybe accommodated some of those things from a physical, if truly sensor size is the problem, couldn't they have made the Pro a little bit bigger, like make it 6.3 inch, give that size as another differentiator, and then maybe cram a bigger sensor in there?
Sure, they probably could have done that, but keep in mind, the Pro's already expanding in size from 5.8 to 6.1. So this was already, the size already increased.
Yeah, fair.
The last year was weird. You had 6.1, 5.8, and then you had 6.5, right? Is that what it was last year?
Yeah.
And now this year it's 5.4, 6.1, 6.1, 6.7. Which actually makes more sense to me in a lot of ways, because it always seemed, I think as a consumer, it's confusing a little bit. I think consumers associate larger numbers with better, for better or worse. And so the 5.8 Pro might sound worse on paper than a 6.1 inch X or 11 last year. So they already increased it. So I guess that, you know, but the footprint of the 6.1 is still pretty small. It's actually not, I think slightly smaller than the 11 was last year, because they managed to, you know, decrease the bezel size and do some other things. So the answer is probably yes. Like, I think probably you're right. They probably could have done a 6.3, and that's still a small enough compared to the 6.7 that it's like, oh yeah, there's a difference. And maybe squeeze that stuff in, but who knows? Maybe even then you couldn't. You know, maybe it was just, hey, we would really have to make the phone. You know, maybe the 12 Max is the size that you have to make it to include those, you know,
the optics,
the optical package that they're including. I don't know. But yeah, overall, like, it'll be interesting to see, again, in a year with COVID, where a lot of people are, like, hurting for money, their phones got more expensive. And when you're really looking at what they are bringing to the table versus last year, I just don't see a lot of compelling reasons to upgrade. Now, iPhones are impervious to this, so it doesn't matter. They'll probably sell 80 gazillion and I'll end up being wrong, because that's always the way I roll when it comes to predicting Apple. But it seems like a lackluster year for me.
Yeah, and one of the other things that I wanted to touch on before we kind of wrap up the iPhone discussion is, there was a lot that was made. So you brought up the MagSafe stuff, right? So magnets on the back of a phone, yay, who knew? But one of the reasons that MagSafe made such news, not only because it's incredibly popular or was popular, used a MagSafe charger to charge my MacBook Pro, but Apple made the decision to remove the charging brick and the EarPods from the boxes this year, citing environmental concerns and the fact that most people are upgrading from an iPhone to an iPhone, so they already have that rinky-dink-ass 5-watt, you know, wall charger anyway, so why give them to people anyways? But I was listening to the Vergecast from Friday, I think, when they were talking about the Apple announcements, and Nilay floated this theory, and I want to run it by you. I think it was Nilay. It might have been Dieter. So if Nilay or Dieter, if you're listening, I apologize. What do you think about them going to MagSafe? Because instead of converting from Lightning to USB-C, they want to convert from Lightning to portless phones.
No, I mean, this isn't a rumor. This is, I think Prosser and those guys have just straight up said that is the goal. I think we're less likely to see a Type-C iPhone than we are a portless iPhone. That's where they're going. They're going portless. And in order to do that, you have to solve this problem, and this is kind of their solve, I guess. But no question, that's where they're going. They're I don't think we'll ever see a Type C iPhone. I could be wrong. Who knows, really? But like, I think if they do Type C, I think the reason they don't actually is because I think it would be like a year, and then I think they would move to the portless like thereafter. And it's like, well, why even bother if you're going to do it for that short of a time?
Here's why you bother. What port is used on the iPad Pros?
Oh no, Type C.
What port is used on all of the MacBook Pro lines this year and last year?
Type C.
So why in the hell would they convert most of their high-end line to a universal USB Type-C standard and still keep Lightning in the iPhones? Now, granted, maybe the Mini and the 12 you keep as Lightning, but why not convert the Pros? I mean, obviously, other than to have the SKUs, but they have SKUs of iPads that run off of Lightning and then run off of USB-C too, so it seems very unusual and very, if you'll forgive me, very un-Apple-like to have your iPad and your MacBook charge off of a different charge. Like, your MacBook cannot charge your iPhone. Like, the hell, man? What is up with that?
No, it is bizarre, but I feel like they got caught in a weird place of, like, I think that they can sell. So, on the iPad and the, MacBook side, I think you can sell people that these are, like, more pro devices, and people just expect to be able to use them something more akin to a computer where, like, I don't think you could get away with a portless laptop. You could try, but I don't think you can, right?
Yeah, I agree.
So I think consumers, the expectation there is that it's more like a computer. But with a phone, I actually do think that you can say, okay, we have MagSafe, we have wireless charging, we have all these other standards for transferring data wirelessly. This makes the phones less complex. It's something that you don't have to worry about. It's a hardware feature you don't have to worry about failing. It makes it easier to make them waterproof and what have you. It's probably like the same as the headphone jack too. Like, oh, it allows to put a bigger battery or whatever the hell they're going to say.
Yeah, crap.
It's coming. It's coming.
It just seems really weird to me, and it also seems very, very un-Apple-like. It just seems stupid. Like, I don't see any reason why they couldn't do it, other than the fact, like you said, like, if they're really going to go portless, they're like, well, screw it, we're not going to do it for 1 year, so just let people suck it up and deal with it. And, maybe they can't get, the licensing money for licensing the Lightning standard, a bunch of people to make accessories for them, which are going to do. And they certainly can and will license the MagSafe stuff to get additional income from that, because eventually, if we do have portless phones, portless iPhones in particular, well, you got to charge it with something. So, how am I going to get that on there? Well, you can buy MagSafe charging cases from Belkin or Anker or any of these other, Nomad or any of these other third-party smartphone accessory manufacturers, and basically say, like, okay, this is the new Lightning standard. It's a wireless charging, and it is, quote-unquote MagSafe, but it is really just a new way to get power into your device by using this technology, which is going to replace Lightning, and it's going to be its own thing. Unlike, the Android world, where largely USB-C has kind of taken over and become kind of like the universal standard. And it is an open standard, which is really nice, especially if you want to use a cable to charge your laptop and charge your tablet and charge your phone. Like, you can use the same cable. You don't need three different cables for three different devices. The argument to remove the brick and the ear pods is kind of like, well, we want to save the environment. Well, you know what you could have done to save the environment? Not invented another charging standard that people are going to have to go out and buy accessories for. Like,
yeah, and not only that, like, the whole thing rings hollow to me. It's like, when you look at what they're charging for a brick and everything else, like, pure and simple to me, this is another way for them to increase their margin on their iPhones. But it's like, it's super ironic that, of course, did the phones get less expensive with the removal of those things?
Nope.
No, they're more expensive this year than they were the year before.
True.
So it cracks me up, but Apple can get away with it. People have, they've been shown thus far to be impervious to these kinds of changes. Their customers will continue to do it, pay and do these things. And yeah, I don't know. I just, I would, if I were a betting man, my bet would be on a portless iPhone before a Type-C iPhone.
Yeah.
And my also bet would then be that Android OEMs will probably
follow suit. Not too long thereafter.
In the not-too-distant future. But, yep. But that kind of sucks. It's like, you know, if your wireless charger stops working, then your phone's dust in the wind.
Yeah,
right?
You're pretty much SOL at that point.
Yeah, so it'll be an interesting time, but that's where my money is. I don't know if it'll be next year or the year after, but it's got to be coming soon.
I hear you. So, you want to talk about the 8T at all?
We can talk about it a little bit real quick. I mean, it's...
So, longtime friend of the show, Alex, is a OnePlus fanboy now. He has the 7 Pro. Do you think he's even considering the 8T at all?
I wouldn't. I don't think the 8T is... I'd much rather have an 8 Pro than I would an 8T. Last year, the 7T was like really the sweet spot of everything.
It's a good phone.
I was a big fan of that. But now it's like, well, it's basically an 8, so they kept all of the 48 megapixel and the camera optics, which is the weakest point of the 8. They added a monochrome and they added this
macro.
Ridiculous 2 megapixel macro, whatever the hell it is.
Two megapixel, by the way. 2 megapixel. Hello, 2007 wants its camera module back.
So it's like the upgrades are, it has a nicer 120Hz screen, which is great. It's got a bigger battery, and the battery's like split into two. It's like two batteries.
Yeah, the two pods, yeah.
Faster to charge.
65 watt fast charging.
Yeah, but I can only just imagine what that's doing to your battery. But okay,
shredding
so you have
it,
that.
Yeah.
But no wireless charging, and the cameras weren't improved. And so when I look at it for $749, it's like, well, I'd much rather have and no official IP rating.
Nope.
Unless you get the T-Mobile version.
Yeah.
So it's like when you look at all of those things, it's like, why would I want that over an S20 FE? I guess becomes my immediate question.
Yeah. For $50 cheaper, no less. And, you know, OnePlus has done some really interesting stuff. There have been a lot of beef about their the updates to Oxygen OS, making it look more like Samsung's One UI, which, you know, you can argue for, you can argue against. You know, they're still brutally fast. The OnePlus 8T does come with a SKU that I think is 12 gigs of RAM, 256 gigs of internal storage. So you're getting a relatively, you know, future-proof phone. It's got the latest flagship. It's fast now. It's going to stay fast for a number of years. The cameras are not fantastic. They're just okay. You could, you know, install Gcam port on it if you wanted to, I guess. And now that they have the ability, I did this on my 7T, to use Gcam and use all three of the lenses, you get a little bit better quality image out of it. So there's some things you can do to mod that phone, but I agree with you. If I was, and I am, an owner of the OnePlus 7T, like if I look at the 8T and I go, do I really want a 120Hz screen? Do I really want an updated processor? Do I really want 4 more gigs of RAM and double the storage? Like, do I really want to pay $750 for it? That's a tough sell.
It's kind of weird. Like, OnePlus was my OEM of the year last year, I think. I felt like their phones last year overall, the 7 Pro, the 7T, everything they did was like, man, what you're doing makes a lot of sense to me. And then this year, the 8 didn't make complete sense to me and was expensive. The 8 Pro was nice, but then they had, like, supply problems and also very expensive. And then
the Nord didn't even launch here.
Head scratcher.
Yeah, and the Nord, which was probably their best bet from a value proposition standpoint, didn't even launch in the U.S.
Didn't bring here.
Yeah.
They've had a weird year, and I don't...
Carl Pei left.
For me.
Yeah. One of their co-founders left the company. Like, it's just a strange. As much as some of these OEMs, like Apple's probably gonna. I mean, they're gonna sell a crap ton of phones, but the 12s are kind of just meh. Like, I like the 12. I can't see a ton of value in the Mini and the 12 Pro and the 12 Pro Max are just. You know, they should have called them the 11S and just called it a day. I think Google pumped out some really good value phones. Like the 4A was probably, and still maybe, you know, the phone of the year. Like for what you get for $350 is crazy. The 4A 5G is, you know, some people will tell you it's what the Pixel 5 should have been. And, you know, I would tell you that the Pixel 5 is Google's ultimate phone. Like, this is their destiny to sell like upper mid-tier phones at reasonable prices that do all of the Google things well. You got Samsung, which punched out the S20 and S20 Plus and Ultra. The S20 Plus, which we have in our house, is a great phone and I love it a lot. The FE is a really, really nice phone and a super compelling value at $699. So they had a pretty good year. The Notes were, you know, the Note Plus is a good phone. The regular Note 10 should not exist in any universe, alternate reality.
Yeah, the Note 20, the Note 20 is like one of the weirdest misses of all time.
Yeah.
Like, I don't actually know what happened there. It's bizarre that the same company that made the FE made the Note 20 within like a few months of each other. It's like, I guess the company's literally so large they must not talk to each other, but it makes no logical sense whatsoever. So, and you know, look, their phones were really overpriced this year. Samsung's too. Like the S20 was, it's insane to start a phone at $999. I mean, for the base.
Yeah.
So they kind of had a weird year, but you know, I think the Z Fold 5G is really interesting. Z Flip 5G is a really interesting phone, and the Z Fold 2 is great. The Note 20 Ultra is great. So they had a good year overall. I think the OnePlus 8 Pro is a good phone, but OnePlus had a weird year, and the not bringing the Nord over was a bizarre miss. And then LG did some LG stuff, like the V60 was fine, and the I actually really like the Wing.
The Wing, baby. Phone,
but and then and, you know, and then Apple had this kind of. So yeah, I mean, if you were asking me like the standout phones of like which phones were the most interesting for me this year, it would be probably the OnePlus 8 Pro, the Z Flip 5G and Z Fold 2 5G.
The foldables, yeah.
The Note 20 Ultra. I think the Pixel 5 is really interesting. And then I would also probably say, like, I think that the 12 Pro Max is an interesting phone, although, you know, again, when you start getting into, well, what actually changed in the money and those kinds of things, it gets tough. But and I really do like the Wing, so LG even has interesting phones. But, yeah, overall, like, every year, overall, the overall quality of the phones is really good, but there's just bizarre things that happen every year, and I guess we should just be used to it by now.
Yeah.
But it is strange. It's, you know, for every good thing Samsung does, they bring out the Note 20 for $999. It's like, what the hell are you doing?
I think, like, was that the one where MKBHD's review of it was Note 20, this ain't it, chief?
Yeah, I mean, it's just objectively, like, ridiculous. Its existence, it shouldn't exist. I think I just said that on our podcast.
Yeah.
It has no reason to exist. It should not exist. But anyway, you know, overall, the phones are really good. Kind of, we are in the splitting hairs territory, and people can pick what they like. And yeah, you know, there you go.
Good deal. Any final thoughts before we wrap it up? We went a little bit long, but I think we covered a lot of ground, and it was important because Techtober has a ton of stuff that we needed to get through. But any final thoughts?
No, you know, again, I think we're kind of at the end of the year, so we're not going to see anything else. And overall, I would say this year was pretty solid for smartphones. There were some definite standouts, but I think overall you can see that innovation and stuff is lagging. And it'll be interesting to see what happens kind of next year as, again, I'm expecting a year of like incremental updates. We'll probably get under screen cameras and we'll get 120 hertz on the iPhones, but then what else next year are we going to get? I'm not really sure. They said they're pretty mature products and they're really good. And it's like, you know, maybe we've just kind of hit a stagnation standpoint until foldables start getting really good.
Yeah. If we can get that Z Flip 2 5G with, or Z Flip 3 5G with a bigger outside display, that to me is a really, really compelling product. And I definitely want to take a closer look at that. You know, I don't know if I'm compelled to buy it at $1,399, but it certainly, that would be the most intriguing thing that I'm looking forward to in 2021 is what Samsung can do with the iterations of their foldables, because they're going to have a huge lead and do have a huge lead. And I think they're only going to get better from here as people try to play catch up. They're going to be kind of the gold standard for foldables and, you know, may really have cornered the market there. And their display tech is something else. So I'm looking forward to that
we'll
for
see.
Sure. Cool. Right on.
Man.
Thanks.
I think we've done it.
Yep. Absolutely. Another award-winning podcast, as always. So take it easy, my dude.
On that note, good night.
Have a good night.
Bye.
So that's the show, everybody. Thanks again for listening. And remember, you can subscribe or follow the podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you enjoyed the show, make sure you tell a friend. It really helps the channel out. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, we will talk tech soon.